We've learned that we've got to reduce our emissions if we want to save this planet. We've also learned that decisions about how to do that are intensely political, and mostly we've learned that change is very, very hard. Tonight, what we've learned, part one of our special series, live from the Equinox Summit in Waterloo, Ontario.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
We are at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario, home to the greatest concentration of theoretical physicists since the Manhattan Project of the 1940s, and the site of this week-long conference on our energy future. It's called the Equinox Summit. We are here where leading scientists, policy experts, and industry representatives are gathered to envision a low-carbon, electrified future and to come up with a blueprint to get us there by the year 2030. And hi, everybody, I'm Steve Paikin, and we welcome you to our broadcast here in Waterloo tonight. We are streaming this event as well, the entire conference also being streamed on our website, tvo.org/theagenda. We're also hosting a live chat there tonight on our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. We hope you'll check out our Facebook page as well in case you want to make any comments. That's facebook.com/theagenda, or you can send us a tweet, twitter.com, and the hashtags you can use are Your Agenda or Equinox Summit. So please join in, those of you who care about energy, the environment. This next hour is for you. And now it's down to business. We are going to sort of set the table, as it were, for five programs that we're rolling out this week, all on the issue of how we are going to meet our energy needs over the next two decades. Energy is a complicated topic, and lucky for us, we have five very impressive experts to help us figure it all out tonight. And they are Václav Smil. He is Distinguished Professor in the Faculty of Environmental Studies at the University of Manitoba and the author of Energy, Myths and Realities. Zoe Caron. She is Climate and Policy Advocacy Specialist for WWF Canada. Marlo Reynolds, Senior Advisor with the PEMDA Institute. Robin Batterham, President of the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineers and former Chief Scientist of Australia. And Alain Aspuruguzic, Professor of Chemistry at Harvard University. Great to have all five of you here this evening. Hope you're enjoying your time in Waterloo here at the Equinox Summit. I want to start by just playing a little bit of tape, once again, to sort of help set the table for the discussion to come. So Michael Smith, if you would, roll tape.
It's everywhere. You see it on the news, in your newspaper, on the net. We're running out of oil. The use of coal and oil is at its highest peak in history. Energy prices are going through the stratosphere. We are dependent on non-renewable fossil fuels, what some call high-carbon energy. And at the rate and way we're using energy, that might lead to irreversible damage. A global crisis is coming. What will we do? Will factories go silent? Homes dark? Economies grind to a halt? The world in chaos? Terra incognita? Or is there a map we can follow?
Robin, that paints a pretty bleak picture, but I want to start by asking, we know where we are. Where do you think we should have been by this time in our history?
I think we've been slow learners, and that's sort of why we are where we are. We could have been a lot lower. We could have followed different trajectories. We've followed the trajectory that we're on for totally logical reasons, totally reasonable reasons. However, we're now looking back and saying with glorious hindsight, whoops.
So what are the logical reasons that have us where we are tonight?
Well, the logical reasons are, quite frankly, that coal is exceedingly cheap. It doesn't cost much to dig up, and you get an awful lot of value out of it in burning it. Similarly, while some will talk about peak oil and so forth, I'd remind you that the marginal cost of production of oil is still only $10 a barrel. Now, why it should be selling for 100, that's a different story, but you get my point, that oil is still actually relatively cheap and extraordinarily convenient. So, you know, we're creatures of habit, we like our creature comforts. Why should we do it the hard way when it's sort of easier where we are at the moment?
Let me follow up with Vaclav. Have we missed numerous opportunities over the years to do better than where we are right now?
Well, of course, we could be consuming half as much as we are consuming, maybe even only a third much as we are consuming, but it's a matter of choice. People want to do what they want to do. People want to overconsume and more. That's been the leading motivation in this continent. People want bigger houses, people want bigger cars, and industries have been somewhere. You look at some of these statistics, it's astonishing what happened in within, you know, one lifetime. In 1950, I use it in common measures, square feet, which people are familiar with this continent. Average house in North America was 1,100 square feet. Now the average house is 2,500 square feet, and average custom built house is more than 4,000 square feet. So these are, and the same happened with cars. And actually, our cars, in terms of energy consumption, have been going backwards. They've been becoming less efficient from 1930s until 1975. And then they became more efficient only between 75 and 85. And then between 85 and now, their efficiency remained steady. So we've lost zillions of opportunities to do better.
Zoe, I want to find out from you as an environmentalist whether you are depressed about the fact that most people seem to want to do things the easy way. They don't want to make the tough choices, and therefore we are where we are.
I'm certainly not depressed, although I do wake up thinking about climate change every day, and it certainly is a challenge. But at the same time, I mean, I'm forced to look forward 50 years, obviously. And so I don't know. I see a very optimistic turn happening. And I say that because I think it took us a really long time to understand that we all had to come forward in this together, as a collective, as the mass of people that we are on this planet. And it took a while for public education to really get out there, for books to be written about climate change, for solutions to climate change to be written. That's really just started to happen in the last 6-7 years on a very public level. And now people get it. Most of Canadians, the majority of Canadians, now understand the impacts of the causes of climate change, and now we're just beginning to bring in the solutions, and I think that's a huge accomplishment.
I wonder whether our friend from the Pembina Institute agrees with that.
Well, I mean, I think like any major challenge that society wrestles with, you go through this process of awareness building, and I still think we're only scratching the surface of
so we don't get it.
I don't think we do get it. I mean, you know, put it into context, you know, if all the scientists of the major national science academies around the world said there's an earth-killing meteorite that's going to likely hit us with a 50% probability and destroy the Earth, what would be our expectation on our governments and our companies to actually react to something like that? It'd be a whole different level of action. And we're not seeing that level of getting from awareness to knowledge to really deepening into the action side.
So Alain, do you understand why there has been, by many accounts, way too little action so far?
Well, I think what we're waiting for is some defining moment that makes, you know, it's kind of paradoxical. We might need an emergency, like another big Katrina or something to wake people up. It's kind of sad to say that, but I think when something like that happens, or the oil prices go really high for a long time, not for a peak, then perhaps people will start thinking about it. And humanity can do these kinds of things, like think about the mobilization that happened in the Second World War. We could mobilize to actually try to change our energy, makeup.
Mix.
But you know, we still haven't been scared enough, I think.
Well, let me throw a few numbers out here and see if this scares anybody a little bit more. Michael, if you would, our first graphic tonight. How abundant is the energy? Look at the sun. The sun emits 86,000 terawatts of energy. With wind, we could get another 870 terawatts of energy. There are about 32 terawatts of geothermal energy underneath the crust of the Earth. And water could net us another 7.2 terawatts of energy. And we're going to throw around a lot of terms tonight which may not sound completely familiar to people. We're working on kilowatts per hour and this kind of thing. But let's see how we do here. Let's do a little definitions as we go here. What's a watt? Energy is like water volume. Power is like water flow. Remember that tonight. Power is measured in watts. So how do we measure it? 1 kilowatt is, of course, 1,000 watts, and that's enough electricity to power a toaster. 1 megawatt is 1,000,000 watts, and that's enough electricity to power a small town. 1 gigawatt is 1,000,000,000 watts, and that's enough energy to power about 1,000,000 homes. 1 terawatt, you'll hear a lot tonight about terawatts, that's 1,000,000,000,000 watts, and global power consumption People argue about these figures a bit, but let's go tonight with 13 terawatts, 13 trillion watts. In the year 2050, global power is estimated to be needed to be 30 terawatts, more than double where we are today in the next 40 years alone. Okay, Alain, that sounds like an enormous undertaking. You work in solar energy, as we saw from that graphic. Solar energy is plentiful. Could we really have been much further ahead in developing solar as a potential energy source than we are right now?
Well, yes, I mean, when we got scared back then in the 70s, the United States created, for example, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, and there was a big source of research on this. But then the political winds changed in the 80s, and then the funding just was depleted, and solar was not something that somebody looked at and researched. Now go to any department, and now people are doing research again in solar and battery technology and so on. So there's a resurgence on research. But we could have researched the technology, 30 years ago or something, and we just basically didn't advance too much the technology in solar, I think.
So should we be closer to harnessing that solar power?
I think that the bigger piece of it, personally, I think, is the efficiency and conservation. I think that's really half of what we're looking at in terms of dealing with the issue, and that has to do with so many different things, whether it's fuel economy standards for our cars or how we build buildings. I mean, we could build our buildings so that you don't even have to have heat or cooling coming in. There are very intelligent designs, and I think that the efficiency piece of it is really going to help us get to where we're going. And the other thing is how we develop energy in developing countries, because the more prosperous, I guess, happy, or the more energy that a community has and the more happy you are about that, the lower that your population rate rises. And that's kind of another interesting piece that plays into it, because population is obviously a major factor here as
we pick up on the energy piece of this, because we got a lot of lights on in here. And Michael, I don't know if you can go to a wide shot here and show the room, but we saw some videos yesterday at the opening ceremonies here where they talked about coal-fired generation. When you put the coal into the furnace and the furnace starts to burn, do you know how much of it goes up the stack? How much efficiency you lose just by the smoke going up the stack? Is it 65%? Did I hear that right? You lose 65% efficiency right away. By the time these bulbs in this room get lit, you're using 2% efficiency of what was originally 100%. This seems like a crazy way to do business. Robin, can we not do better than this?
Well, we can do a lot better than that, of course. And one of the first things you start at, your key point, is way back at the source. We take out an energy, we take out a lump of condensed sunshine, because that's what coal is. Go back into what formed coal. And then we take such a small portion of it. So one question is, how can you make lights more efficient? But a far better question is, I'm not criticizing your question, Steve.
Appreciate it.
But a far better way of going is to say, all right, at what sort of level do we need energy? There are some things where we really don't need very intense energy, so keep the intense sources for when we need intense energy, and keep lower grade heat, so to speak, for where you've got it. So there are all sorts of ways you can tackle this one and cut it down. But one of the key things is to say intense sources are really very precious. We've got to learn to value them in a different way.
Václav, where are you on this?
I want to introduce something which kind of negates almost everything that's been said here. It doesn't matter what we think and what we do. It's what China does. See? Because, Canadians may or may not understand global warming energy. It doesn't matter. 34 million people, a Chinese city. That's all what's to it. Chinese, it took Americans 100 plus years to burn 1 billion tons of coal per year. Chinese added 1 billion tons of coal by 2003 to another 2 billion tons which were burning before, and another 1 billion tons since. So Chinese are now burning more than 3 billion tons of coal every year, and they are still importing coal from Australia on top of
it. But I hear they are at the leading edge of developing renewables. Isn't that the case?
Well, but if you burn more than 3 billion tons of coal a year, then if you build, even when you build lots of wind capacity, it's nothing. It's a very tiny fraction. And the same India. So these countries will burn as much coal as fast as they can put their hands on it. So what we do, it's so marginal, it almost doesn't matter.
Zoe, I see you rolling your eyes there.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you were.
I should never play poker. This is to build. I don't disagree with anything he just said. The additional piece of that, I guess, is to think about how much we use as individuals, for one. I mean, people in China use a fraction of what we use. Obviously, it's growing, but that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing I think to keep in mind is that the investments that China is making in green energy is really shifting the marketplace around the world. And the third thing is that Canadians, while we are a very small piece of the global population, I think that there may be more than we think to our renewable energy potential in Canada and what we could stand to deliver to the United States. And that's a huge, massive piece of potential in terms of shifting where energy comes from on the face of the planet. So that's a huge piece that Canadians should really be looking forward to. It's not just us, it's what we can deliver.
Okay, so Marlo, which is it? We're insignificant in the whole scheme of things, or we've got a leadership role to play?
You know, I think it's a real combination of what Zoe is saying is, you know, in the Western world where we are heavy consumers of energy, we have to drastically redesign our infrastructure, our homes, our buildings, our how we move ourselves. But in the developing world where, you know, I mean, there's serious energy poverty. There's several billion people who've never turned a light switch on in their life. So you're not dealing with energy efficiency there. You really are looking at how do you get them onto solar, local, safe, community-based energy systems. And I think with respect to China, you know, often we talk about these graphs of increased demand of oil coming out of China. And it's not demand for oil. It's demand for mobility. You know, so there's a real potential where they could say, we're going to meet that energy service in different ways. We're going to look at the electric vehicle. We're going to look at different ways of moving ourselves about, designing our cities, and we're going to just leapfrog oil altogether.
Robin.
Dive in on that and say, yes, but I've got to agree, there's going to be an awful lot of coal burnt in China for the next 20, 30 plus years. There are, of course, promising signs. I'd look at something more like the fact that China is the only country in the world spending 12% of its GDP on public transport. They now have a better high-speed rail network than Germany, where I live for a good bit of the time, than France, than Japan, the homes of high-speed rail. Chinese rail now runs faster. They are very, very reliable. They are very, very comfortable. 12% of GDP going on public transport. So they're not going to come up the same curve that we've come up in terms of the amount of energy that we use shifting people around. But they're still going to burn a lot of coal.
Well, that's the point. They may be doing these wonderful things in renewables and public transport, but if they are powering those things with coal-fired generation, then they're not any further ahead, are they?
So should we just immediately ask them to stop digging up coal and just make it all nuclear?
I don't think it matters what we ask. They're going to do what they're going to do, right?
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. I should just take a moment here before we go on. Václav, I want to do a quote from your book. But before we do, Michael, I don't know if you can get a shot of this up here. But those of you who are in the hall here will be noticing above my head up top are the comments that are coming in from our Twitter feeds, from our Facebook page. We just want to remind everybody that they can get on our website, facebook.com/theagenda, or they can send us a tweet, and anybody who's online can follow the comments, the debate that's happening online. In addition, those of you here in the hall are able to follow it as well, and in a few moments' time, we'll go up to the top of the hall, and Mike Miner, who's up at his undisclosed location, although I can see it this week, up at the top of the perch there, will tell us more about what's going on online. Okay, let's go to this next board if we can, Michael. This is from Václav Smil's book, Energy Myths and Realities, and he says the following. By the year 2000, coal-based generation of electricity was to be a relic of the past, with all the demands supplied by nuclear fission and with the super-efficient breeder reactors already taking over. By the year 2000, between 30 and 50% of America's energy use was to come from renewable flows. By the year 2000, the world was to derive half its energy from natural gas. And a decade ago, the promoters of fuel cell cars were telling us that by now such vehicles would be on the road in large numbers, well on their way to displacing ancient and inefficient internal combustion engines. Václav, a lot of smart people made a lot of bold predictions about where we would be today, and they haven't been right.
Fuel cell cars are my favorite. I was lecturing in Vancouver a couple of weeks ago, and that's, of course, the Ballard territory. 11 years ago, in year 2000, starting in early 1990s, this is what happened to Ballard system, to $200 per share. Now it's less than $3, and nobody's talking about fuel cell cars. The history of energy development is littered with wrong and overly optimistic predictions. Absolutely littered. In past 10 years, we've gone from fuel cell cars to everything was to be the hybrid cars. Then everything was to be now, of course, electric car, right? None of those things. By 2020, only a few percent of cars will be electric. Hybrids are slowly moving in, but it's a very, very slow process. All of these things take very, very, very long time. People always underestimate the time it takes to get from A to B in new energy system because infrastructure is massive, expensive, and besides, I will return to the point later, we don't have money. The whole Western world is broke. So all these trillion-dollar investments on this newfangled system, everybody's broke.
So many optimists, Merlo. How come they're all so wrong?
Well, you look at any technology, and there's experts that are, you know, make wild predictions that don't come true. My favorite is, Ken Olson, president of Digital Equipment Corporation, 1977. This is a big mainframe, computer company. His quote in 1977: "No one is ever going to want a computer in their home." I've got one in my pocket. Right? Look at the curve that computing power, traced over the last 30 years. I think we're going to see the same thing. We're starting to see the same thing in solar PV, and I think we're going to start seeing it in batteries and storage.
Except that if Václav is right and we're all broke, will not having the financial resources to tackle this hold us back?
Well, one way or the other, we're spending trillions of dollars on energy, right? It's really choices of how we decide to spend that money. So I think there's, I spent today in Toronto on Bay Street of, a big venture capitalist conference. These are the people making million-dollar decisions on where they're going to put their money. And they're looking at renewable energy, energy efficiency systems, and saying, this is the future. This is the 21st century where we can actually make real money.
Alain, you want to follow up?
Well, I actually think that research and development is very important. So, for example, when the tides turned in the United States and then we got research money for energy, I belong to a thing called the Center for Excitonics. Where, with MIT and Harvard, we're thinking about how to make better PV, how to think about also the basics of how to move energy around in the form of excitations. And what is cool about that is that if you put 20 scientists or so together from different research groups and different backgrounds, and we start talking about things, then things happen, right? And I think this is a policy-driven thing that eventually helps R&D. So I am optimistic in the sense that perhaps not with all the money, Bastard might say we are broke, but perhaps with a decent amount of money compared to, for example, war or something like that, just a fraction of that will take us a long way to accelerate R&D.
Does the economic situation that the world has been going through over the past 3 years, does that hold us back from making more dramatic decisions about the issues we're talking about tonight?
There's three quick points I'll make. One, some of the world is broke. It's called the developed countries. Some of the world is doing very well and hardly hiccuped through the global financial crisis, which should have been called the developed world financial crisis. So that's the first point.
Good point.
Not all of the world is broke. Next point is, well, how much would it cost you if you wanted to go within 10 years to a zero emission Canada or a zero emission Australia? And the answer is, using technology, even without more R&D, which I love, I'm in that business, even without more R&D, you can go zero emission at roughly 3-4% of your GDP disappearing off into leaving assets stranded, putting in nuclear, if that's your fancy, or deep geothermal, or wind up to the level that you can, etc. And you end up with zero emission within 10 years. Now, for some countries, and I haven't done the sums for Canada, it's interesting, 3-4% of GDP per annum, by the way, that's enough for most people to say we're in a heck of a recession if you take away 3-4% of GDP, but this gives you a sense of proportion. That's, for Australian conditions, something like 2 cups of coffee per person per day for 10 years. That's not much.
If it were that easy, Zoe, surely we'd have done it by now.
Well, of course, I'm not the economist in the room, but I mean, there are some very simple pieces, I think, that we still haven't done. I mean, I was shocked when I first learned that Not only Canada, but many governments around the world are still subsidizing the development of oil and coal and gas, the exact types of fuels that we want to be trying to move away from. Yes, they needed subsidies to start up, and we needed those fuels, but now there are many other options that aren't receiving those types of subsidies. And I think that that's just a simple example of where priorities are right now.
Okay. We're about halfway through tonight, so let's just do a little business with the folks at home. Reminder, we are live tonight at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. Just a gorgeous facility here. We're here all week long. Live shows all week long, 8 p.m., repeated at 11, from the Perimeter Institute. We're here partnering with the University of Waterloo at the Equinox Summit. They are looking at what kind of blueprint we need to get us to the year 2030 and have a better energy future. Go to tvo.org/theagenda to learn more about the summit, to join in our web chat this evening, to watch the live streaming of many of the presentations here, and the entire conference, in fact, throughout the rest of the week. And now, as promised earlier, Mike Miner, our fifth column blogger, is watching what's happening online as we're having this debate here in the front part of the studio. Mike is up at the back doing it online. Mike, what have you got for us?
Hi, Steve. Well, all through the day, we've been airing some of these discussions that are happening here at the Equinox Summit online. So there's been a conversation going all day. And one of the things that people online have been discussing over and over again is the level of their concern about this. We have MW, who lives within sight but not within sound of some windmills in Essex County, saying that she was always worried on some level about the environment and having been taught about the alternatives that were out there from high school up. A concern and confusion as to why they weren't being implemented more quickly. She'd always been told that it's the smart thing to do, so why hadn't it already been done? This was a common theme that came up. Astro YYZ, he's got an airport code in his name, but he wants gas prices tripled on airplanes, expresses a concern about China and the developing world bringing so much more car owners and factories online. What's that going to do to the carbon footprint? You know, his concern about people's quality of life is dwarfed by his concern for the planet. Victor expresses a kind of selfish Canadian perspective. He says much of the world will become polluted and have low standards of living due to environmental damage. This is his vision of the future. While Canada will still be ticking along reasonably well because of its vast territory, green space, and the resources, unless the U.S. invades. So that's some of the things that we're hearing online here.
Okay, Mike, thanks a lot. You keep monitoring the chat online, and we will check back with you later, time permitting. Let's go here next. The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change says that the urgency is greater than expected. It's announced that the aim of future negotiations ought to be to hold global warming targets to less than 1.5 degrees Celsius rather than the goal set earlier, which was 2 degrees, by the end of this century. This, Robin, is a tougher target to hit. Can we do it?
Well, there's no doubt that we can do it if we want to. And so you keep coming back to why don't we want to? And I indicated that the amount of money you've got to spend is not all that great, actually, if you really want to move. So I look at it and say, look, I wonder if it's not about credibility and stuff like that and what the IPCC says and so on. It's actually because we haven't got angry enough with ourselves and our forebears for getting us to where we are now and telling us, in effect, you don't have the options going forward that you thought you had. Because once that realization starts to set in, then we'll start more the discussion of saying, look, is it 1.5 or is it going to be 3 degrees or what, whichever way, we don't want it to be 8. So what have we got to do, in fact, to ensure that that doesn't happen? I would suggest to you, haven't been angry enough with our loss of options, because that's really what it comes to. So what does it take to get us angry enough from which the concern will then flow? I'm not sure.
Zoe, what's the answer to that? what will it take to get us angry enough to force politicians to make some decisions that Robin would like to see them make?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think a big piece of this is all of us understanding what the solutions are, and that's obviously what this conference is about. But I think on a day-to-day level, and we did some really interesting polling just to get an idea of where Canadians were in terms of getting climate change, and there's three things that generally a person needs to become either involved in their community or politically or become engaged on something, and one is to think an issue is important, one is to think it's urgent, and the third is to understand the solutions. And when you poll the majority of Canadians on, you know, on what the solutions are, most people don't know. And I think that that's why this conference has huge importance and why we in our professions, you know, moving forward, really need to be communicating what that means. And it is largely about energy and other things. So that's a piece of it.
Václav, Robin says we got to get angry. Is anger a good motivator here?
It's very simple. Given the 9.1% unemployment in the U.S. and the real unemployment and underemployment close to 20%, U.S. Congress will never, Democrats and Republicans as one man, never approve any treaty which will not require the same sacrifices from U.S. as it does from China. And China will never approve any sacrifices which will force it to sacrifice their 12% economic growth to catch up with the United States.
So
as simple as that.
Stalemate.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Merlo.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think it's even the most challenging piece is getting past the pocketbook politics that we're in right now. I mean, you know, look, here in Ontario, investors are saying this is the best place in the world to invest in renewable energy because of the Green Energy Act that's in place. Yet we're going into an actual debate coming into the election this year. It's essentially a referendum on the Green Energy Act. And it's just, you see that, and, you know, it's creating thousands of jobs here in Ontario. It's attracting millions of dollars of capital and investment here. And for it to even be in a debate is just is really frustrating, because one way or the other, a province like Ontario has got to face up to the fact that we are going to have to pay more for electricity. You know, we're living off of past infrastructure. We have not maintained that infrastructure. We need to evolve that into a much cleaner energy system, and that's going to cost some money.
But it turns out that in Europe, there is a vast experience in Spain, in Germany, in Denmark. These green jobs are not so green. They don't last so long. And as most of the government-created jobs, they cost $250,000 per person, and they don't last forever. So, you know, green jobs, there is lots being written about European green jobs.
But that's not held up with the fact that Germany just announced that they're going to completely phase out nuclear and replace it with green energy. So there's an increasing amount of
conflict. We'll see. Come back in 2022. We'll talk about that, right?
They will buy more French nuclear energy. You can be sure of that.
But there is a great debate. I mean, I think you've touched on the fear that people have here is that the green jobs that are coming, A, may not be that permanent, B, may not be that good paying, is that proper grammar? They may not pay well enough. And C, we're subsidizing them too much.
Well, a few things on Germany, because I also live in Germany as well as Australia, and I've got a house there. Let me say that on the roof of our house in Germany, there are some solar heating panels. I regard this as economic nonsense, especially as I had to pay for it. Especially in wintertime, which is when you need the hot water in the heating system in the house, when it's covered in a meter of snow. You know, this sunlight doesn't get through a meter of snow. Furthermore, in the summertime, when you do need a little bit of water, and I found that the marder, which is a weasel? Never had to translate it, so I'm not sure. It's a little animal that's sort of like an overgrown rat. And it gets up onto the roof and it chews off the insulation on the pipes that are meant to carry hot water. So what happens when the temperature's a bit cool? Your water without insulation around the pipes gets cold. I wondered why the thing wasn't in summer even producing any heat into the system. And the answer was that .. had been up on the roof about a week after the insulation. But coming back to the economics thing and Germany, they have at least done some fairly careful sums fairly recently on whether there's been any dividend out of having the massive, and most people would say, myself included, until I saw this latest study, ridiculous feed-in tariff levels that they've had. And the opinion is that when you take a whole economy into view, just the job, green jobs alone don't add up. But when you take the changed attitude of the public, the changed habits that they have in using the public transport more than perhaps driving the car every time, and when you factor in a whole load of, you have to factor in an awful lot of indirects, and that's fine. So it just gets across the line in terms of economic sense. But I think it's a pity, quite frankly, when we've got to resort to very deep, not I've got anything against economists, when you've got to get into very deep economics to prove something that should be pretty simple. Namely, we want to go in that direction. We know it's going to cost us, so let's get on with it.
You know one thing I've got to get you to do before we go any further? Because I'll get Mike Miner right now to ask people online how to translate it. Spell that word that you said before.
The Marder?
Yeah, spell it.
Well, auf Deutsch is M-A-U-D-E-R, Marder.
M-A-U-D-E-R. D-E-R. Okay, Mike Miner, you get on that right now. Get our people online to start translating and get a good one. Marlo, you wanted to say.
You know, I think what we're scratching on is, you know, there is no political will to actually get the full cost of energy embedded in the system. We're not, you know, we're not accounting for the environmental costs. So the easy way out for politicians, because they're not going to, you know, tax carbon, is to say, well, I guess we'll do some subsidies. But when there's no money, it's hard to do that policy. So I'll be the first to say, eliminate those subsidies on renewable energy as soon as we eliminate all the subsidies around oil sands, coal, natural gas, that entire infrastructure. And then we actually have a level playing field where we can play. You know, we're still, you know, any major energy infrastructure development we've done in Canada, name, you know, hydro, the oil sands, have required nuclear, have required massive amounts of public money to start it up. Why would we think it's going to be any different when we go into the 21st century trying to go to renewable energy?
Alan, how does it work in Mexico? What's the energy split there?
Well, Mexico is basically a country that uses a lot of oil, uses a lot of coal, a lot of, you know, energy that I wouldn't like to use. But a surprising example is Costa Rica, that promised that in a few years, and again, Backlab might say it's a promise, but in a few years they're going to become carbon neutral because they have, you know, quite a bit of hydro, and they can, you know, change the balance in such a way that Costa Rica can become carbon neutral, right?
But you've got, you know, the crown jewels there, Pemex, right?
I mean, Pemex is good, but Mexico peaked already, and the production is going down. And therefore, there is discussion about what we're going to do after, you know, this oil bonanza that Mexico has had for quite a while.
Do you think people are seized with this issue in Mexico the way that we hope they are in other parts of the world?
Well, right now there are other problems that people are having trouble with, right? Which is, you know, the war with the drug cartels and you know, etc. But certainly, yes, at least the discussion has been started in that country about the situation, yeah.
Let me put another graphic up right now, and that is, I wonder whether or not this gets us into some discussion about whether it's better, as some of the environmental movements tell us, to, you know, think global but act local. Michael, board number 4, if we could. This is some information, and you folks here in the hall can look up at the screen up top, I think. Kristianstad, Sweden. Small town in the southern part of Sweden. They have weaned themselves off fossil fuels entirely. This is a population of 80,000. They use no oil, no natural gas, no coal to heat their homes. They are converting farming waste into biogas, and that's how they're doing it. Zoe, I wonder whether or not, again, as suggested earlier, maybe the solution isn't in some big Kyoto protocol that the whole world comes together to negotiate. Maybe it's individual small towns getting it started.
I absolutely agree with the fact that the more local you become, the more effective you are. And even when you look at government policies, I think at international level, it's something like 10% effectiveness, federal 25, provincial 50, and when you get to municipal, it's 90% effectiveness. And I think that really applies at the level of creating change as well. I mean, that's an exceptional example. And I think that even, I mean, I can't, you know, I have to agree with Marlo when he speaks about Ontario's example, because that's something that Canada couldn't have done necessarily as a federal government. I mean, that is a provincial responsibility here, and Ontario and Nova Scotia and British Columbia have really taken a lead on this, and I think that's something to be proud of. And even Vancouver, they're taking the municipal action they want to be the greenest city in the world by 2020, and I think they'll do it.
Václav, are the solutions more local than global?
Do those people in the town, do they produce their own food with cows and use their manure and their feces? I suppose no. I suppose if you eat food, we just produce with ammonia fertilizers, with tractors. I suppose they use still electricity from the grid, etc., etc. We are a fossil fuel world. There is no way how you can live without fossil fuels today. It's impossible. The wind turbines are made from fossil fuels. The steel is tower. I mean, the tower is made of steel. The blades are made from plastics. Photovoltaic photovoltaics require a tremendous amount of input in terms of fossil fuel. I mean, we are what we are. We are a fossil fuel civilization. Let's face it. I mean, everything else is a marginal thing.
Okay, so we are, and we just should like it and live with it? Is that the idea?
It's not matter if you like it or not. It's here. It's convenient to use it. The people who use one-third or one-fifth of it, that is people in Asia, they'll follow in our footsteps and will use more of it. It's damn convenient. It's available at your beck and call anytime. You know, you don't have to wait for it to sun, rise up and down, wind blow. It's always there. It has a high energy density. We can make it very efficiently. We can fly with it. We can float with it. We can drill with it. We can do anything with
it. But it's killing our planet.
Yeah, that's what we are doing, you know, but that's what life. Life is very entropic, you know. No, nothing is here forever. We don't live forever. Planet doesn't live forever. Things don't live forever.
Does this sound too pessimistic to you?
I've only got 4 grandchildren. I'm sure there are people around here that have got more grandchildren, you know, plus minus. It's not the point. My mother's 102. So I think there's a, by the way, I took her to London for her 98th birthday, which is environmentally not very sound, flying her from Melbourne to London. My brother had a rather silly notion as to what I was trying to do to her, taking her to London for her birthday. And the answer was she had a good time. But anyway, to get to the point. So I can sort of say, you know, there's a fair chance that my grandchildren, who are sort of age, doesn't matter, it's sort of, in other words, I can't remember, 4 through 12, something like that, at 102, at about 100 to that age, so they're still going to be going in 100 years' time from now. Now, that's long enough for some of these effects to really kick home. So I look at something like the China thing, and I'm not so pessimistic. I would say we should give, this is pretty radical, it's in our interests to be exceedingly generous with anything we develop and let the Chinese copy it or improve it or just plain have it, so that they build it in to their systems with the best practice, the best technology that we can think of. We will as well, by the way, in the long run, we'll wake up and get moving on it. But instead of seeing it as, if you like, an environmental lack of competition, give them anything that's going to help them.
Because the idea is we'll lose the economic development and the jobs, but we'll save the planet.
Anyway, and if they don't get into saving the planet as well as us, the planet, I take the point absolutely, what China does, and India emerging, and Brazil, and there's a whole lineup sitting behind them, thank you very much. If they don't get into the same act, then turn off the optimism.
Marla.
Well, you know, I mean, there's no doubt fossil fuel is going to, you know, play a role. I mean, my colleague to your right feels like he needs a hug or something here to sort of bounce out of things a bit. But, you know, quite frankly, as consumers of energy, we don't care about fossil fuels. We care about the services from energy. You know, when's the last time you woke up and said, oh, great, the vehicle is on E, it's empty. Kids, let's go fill up. You know, it's not what we don't get a buzz out of that. That's not what, you know, if it's plugged in and it's ready to go, you've got your mobility. You know, so I think it's a great time for designers and entrepreneurs and engineers. And I always say, you know, we're going to solve this problem when we send those folks and we stop sending our lobbyists and lawyers.
Václav?
Just one little statistics. China is planning to open up 100 new airports over the next 20 years. China is already importing 60% of its oil, as much as the United States. And these planes, China will order about half of all new planes built in the next 20 years. And these planes are not be going to flying on electricity from sun or wind. They'll be flying on kerosene made from crude oil.
Or algae. Jet fuel from algae.
Let's have a
You've
bet.
Got massive,
Let's have a bet.
Massive
in the next 20 years, there'll be no mass consumption of jetliners flying on algae. Let's have a bet. I bet you any amount of money.
All right. I know how to use my odds well, so I'll bet you for 2050, I'll be 77 and understand and see if whether we've solved this problem.
I said
problem.
Next 20 years. That's not
I never said
time.
Anything about 20 years. But what we're talking about is it really starts about vision. Right, you know, and that's why the work we did with Tides Canada said, what does a new energy vision for Canada look like?
What are you holding there?
It's a document called New Energy Vision for Canada. We published it with Tides Canada, a Vancouver, Toronto organization. And we said, what could Canada look like? And, you know, we workshopped this across the country, gathering a whole bunch of ideas. I encourage people to take a look at it, see if it aligns with their values and thinking. We're going to be presenting that to the Council of Energy Ministers in July, where we've got all the ministers of energy gathered together in Kananaskis country, in my my home territory in the Rockies near Banff. And it is going to be a good, healthy discussion on, you know, what is the energy future look like for Canada?
Václav, I got to ask you this.
An average
before saying,
daily.
Hang on, I got to ask the question. You said before everything dies, right? There's a life cycle to everything. Does it not sound just way too pessimistic to say, you know what, we like our oil, if it ends up killing the earth, c'est
la vie. I don't care if it's pessimistic or optimistic, it's the way it is. These people have choice. They could have bought Honda Civic, but most Canadians buy SUV, which is 18 miles per gallon. That's what they like to drive. And they like to build houses which they cannot afford the size of those houses, and they do it, right? I mean, people just make these like choices. Us. This is not optimistic or pessimistic. This is the way it is. Given half the choice, people want to waste as much energy as they can. That's how it is.
Okay, but China is closing down old coal-fired power stations and putting up new coal-fired power stations, much more than they closed down, and the new ones are far more efficient than the old ones. And they get a double benefit out of this. One, for the same amount of coal, they get more electrons down the wire, which they sell and they need the demand. And two, they have less particulate emissions in towns and the respiratory diseases, which cost them an arm and a leg, go down. So they actually have environmental drivers which are going to drive them. And I'd suggest that if things stay on the path they are and you start to see far more intense winds and the Hadley cell circulation changes, you won't want to be living in Beijing. It's already bad enough in winter with the dust that's in the air from Mongolia. And you can measure it. People measure how much dust gets into the Pacific Ocean from Mongolia. It's charted every year, and it is going up and up.
Speaking of charted, I want to put another chart up. Let's put up, Michael, let's do this one here. Global pressure on energy. Here's worldwide use. We're going to go back 150 years here, and we're going to track how people have used energy from 1850 until present day. And we're going to start back in 1850. You see, it goes along until about 1925, and then the use of gas just explodes. Gas, oil, coal, all the dirty stuff that's ruining the planet. Now, if we took that out of the mix, as we just have on that graphic, those three things are dissolved. Alain, let's start with you here. What alternative energy techniques that we're working on right now seem like the best bet to replace gas, oil, coal, the stuff that's killing our planet?
Well, I think it's going to be really a mix of most of the renewable options that we have. You know, geothermal was discussed today as a very nice option. I am a fan of photovoltaics. We have to bring down the cost, but we're working really hard to do so, right? So photovoltaics have to be in the mix, wind, hydro. So we do have the technologies. It's just a question of how fast we can implement them to really try to bring us, you know, to a sustainable path, right? And that's what we really need to take action today. We cannot wait until tomorrow.
Zoe, yeah. You got any idea what cars we're going to be driving in 20 years that will remove a lot of that smog from the air?
Well, I'm hoping the first car I buy will be a Leaf, an electric car. I mean, if I do buy a car. And I think absolutely right that it'll be a combination of new technologies, of efficiency. WWF globally put out an energy report for our vision for 2050. And based on existing technologies, as you said, 95% of that could be met by renewables and efficiency. And I think that that's incredible to know. And I mean, to have the creativity, as Marlo was saying, and the passion and the drive to create good in the world and to have compassion for people. I mean, I think that that is a huge piece driving us towards really selecting the elements that we want to see in our energy mix.
Václav, we know that in 2008, one of the main parties in this country ran on a green shift. And they talked about paying more to pollute. And we know what happened to them. It was until that time the worst showing the Liberal Party had ever had. This past election, it got even worse. How about pricing? Could you double the price of gas, and would that change people's habits?
Doubling is not enough. In rich countries, not in Europe where people pay so much more than we do here, but in US and Canada, doubling anything is totally inelastic. That's not enough. You have to start tripling and quadrupling. We just basically pay nothing for energy. As a part of our disposable income, we pay nothing. Doubling is nothing. You know, you have to triple. You have to quadruple. Because, you know, people pay less for energy than they pay for whatever, you know, gambling in Las Vegas or buying their SUVs. And it's just, oh, yes, we haven't even started to increase the prices. What's happening so far? We need basically an equivalent of about like $500 a barrel oil. That's what we need. $100, it's nothing. That's still cheap. When you discount for inflation, and when you discount for lower oil intensity of economy, and when you discount for higher disposable income over the past 30 years, we pay for oil less than we paid in our lifetime, basically.
Okay, you know what, though? As you were saying, triple, quadruple the price of gas, and I saw five heads going like this, and none of you could get elected dog catcher running on that kind of platform. It's true. Who's gonna get elected on that kind of platform of tripling the price or quadrupling the price of gas?
Well,
Marley.
Well, I mean, and it's absolutely right. We have to get ready to start paying more for energy. At the same time, we have to realize that even in our own country, very wealthy, there are a million Canadians that every month make a choice of whether they're paying their rent or their utility bill. Right? We have energy poverty. We don't even have a definition for energy poverty in this country, let alone a strategy to actually address it. So we have to be coupling these both, that there is going to be a need to address the realities of energy poverty while having to make this transition.
Alain, I've heard you talk about a need to create a kind of a Manhattan Project for changing the way we use energy towards the year 2030. What's standing in the way of that Manhattan Project happening?
I think what we have discussed in a few meetings at my university is being scared. I mean, why did the people start building cars in the war and started building planes instead? Because they were scared, right? And they said, we need planes, you know, to fight these other guys, right? So we need to be motivated as a society, and I think it's kind of like a mobilization as we were hearing, right? If you're spending 5% of your GDP is enough for decarbonizing your society in a certain amount of time, there's a very reasonable choice that you have to make. You just have to be on board. And right now, I mean, the public is not on board with this, and this is what I really want to drill. Manhattan Project, in terms of also spending in research, right? If we make things cheaper, more practical and so on, the learning curve goes faster. You know, we have to install more of these plants to learn how they work, to make them better and so on. And that takes time, and we don't have a lot of time.
I want to hear the others on that as well, but speaking of not having a lot of time, we got about 3 minutes left, which is enough time for me to say, what was that word in German you said before?
Mauder.
Mauder? Pine, what is it again?
Pine Martin.
The Pine Martin. The European Pine Martin. The root of all evil.
That one wrong.
That's what it is. We found out.
We have found the problem.
We have indeed. Zoe, what's stopping another Manhattan Project from happening?
I think that a lot of it honestly comes down to public participation, and that's obviously speaking from a Canadian point of view, but I mean, I come back to this polling that we did because I found it really interesting in terms of what the breakdown was. When you look at who's voting and who's becoming engaged at a high level and in their communities, it is mostly older men. And when you look at who cares about the issues, and this is obviously very averaging it out, but it's men and women between the ages of 25 and 35, and it's involved women who are very engaged in their communities and very influential. And I think that recognizing the power we have as individuals and as communities and really becoming engaged on energy and climate change is a huge missing piece of the solution that everybody in this room has the ability to do, and that it's completely necessary to moving forward.
Okay, Robin, got a couple of minutes left here. Let me try this. In Ontario, of course, 50% of our power is generated by nukes. It's been said that you can be against nuclear energy or against global warming, but not against both at the same time. Do you agree?
For the next 20 years, that's right. Simple answer.
That is true?
Yep.
You can't be against both?
Not if you, you can't do what Germany is doing and just pull the plug on nuclear and expect that something else is going to take its place. And the answer is it's going to be the coal-fired power stations, brown coal, which is a bad as you can get, brown coal fired power stations running at higher capacity levels than they have been. So next 20 years, these are long-term investments. So you can't just turn them off.
Marlo, you may have to embrace nukes. Can you do it?
Well, we always look at electricity and energy choices on a regional perspective, especially around electricity. I'm not going to comment on whether nuclear is good for Germany or France or China.
How about for Ontario?
I'm going to look at Alberta. You know, hot debate on nuclear. It just can't compete. We have such other options before we'd actually go to nuclear from a cost perspective and from a reliability perspective. Again, set a level playing field. I don't think nuclear can compete in that particular context. So I think it's not worthwhile being anti-nuclear. You take you out of the debate. It's about putting about context of what is the situation you're looking at. And I think this comes back to the Manhattan piece. This is both a challenge in the sense that there isn't sort of a silver bullet technology. But what's the exciting part is it actually requires all of us to be part of the solution here. And that can build a lot of community, and that can move us a lot further forward.
And that seems like a great place to leave it tonight. Václav, Marlo, Zoe, Alain, Robin, thank you so much for joining us here at the Perimeter Institute this evening. I want to thank the audience for taking time out of their lives to come by and listening to our debate this evening. Appreciate it, everybody. For more information about tonight's guests and this Equinox Summit, and to read an excerpt of Václav Smil's book, Energy, Myths, and Realities, we invite you to go to our website, tvo.org/theagenda. Tonight's program is produced by Vodek Schemberg, Sandra Jonas, and Allison Buck-and-Terrell. And you can read our Mike Miners blog post, and it's entitled Our Carbon Blanket. It's about how bad our emissions are in this country. That's on our Inside Agenda Producers blog. Once again, you'll find it on our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. We'll be right back after this with a look at tomorrow night's program from the Perimeter Institute, right after this.
Sailed into Kowloon Harbor, one in three would never return home.
For King and Country, tonight at 10 on TVO.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
Okay, and now we wrap it up from night one. I want to remind everybody that this is just the first of five programs that we're doing from the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo, Ontario. We're partnering with, of course, the PI, with the University of Waterloo. We're going to have everything on this. So feel free at any time during the course of the day to go to our website. That's tvo.org/theagenda. They've got terrifically interesting sessions going on all day here. You can eavesdrop in on those. As you've seen during the course of our broadcast, you can join the discussion groups. We're always up at facebook.com/theagenda or on our website, tvo.org/theagenda. So we hope you will join us every night this week at 8 or 11 o'clock, if that's more convenient for you, to get into our five special programs on energy looking forward. And that is the agenda for D-Day, Monday, June the 6th, 2011, 67th anniversary of D-Day. Tomorrow night, our program we're calling Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Join us for a closer look at transportation as we consider our energy future and continue our week-long special series from the Equinox Summit. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO, for joining us online at tvo.org, and we'll see you again from the Perimeter Institute tomorrow night in Waterloo, Ontario. Good night, everyone.